We're ready for John chapter 15, verse 16. Here in John chapter 15, the chapter before, the chapter after, we're dealing with some key themes. Three of those items would be?
We both forgot our hearing aids.
Okay.
We yell.
All right. Well, we may not yell, but we will try to make sure that most are able to hear it. Here in John chapter 15, we've got three major themes. We've talked about love. We'll see that again tonight. We've talked about joy. And we've also got some information about peace. We have been, as you look at the last week or two, also talking about the fact that Jesus said the apostles were going to be his friends, and he's had a lot to say. If you love me, you'll keep my commandments, we're going to be friends, if you follow my will, these kinds of things. We talked a little bit about this last week. There is only, this could be counted, I guess, in a slightly different way, but in the Bible, there is only one person as far as the Old Testament, and I'm really thinking Genesis to Malachi, there's only one person who was identified as a friend of God. Anybody remember who it is? Abraham. Now, if you were to look at John 11, verse 11, you have a man by the name of Lazarus. He died. And Jesus said to the apostles, let's go see our friend Lazarus. So if you want to say the Old Testament, which, I guess you could technically say that. And then, if you look at Moses, there is a statement in the Bible which says that God spoke to Moses as a friend would speak with friend. Now, that doesn't specifically call him a friend, but it does use that comparison when Moses is being portrayed. So I find that very, very interesting that really the Old Testament, Genesis to Malachi, you have only one guy, Abraham, referred to as a friend of God. Moving forward into the New Testament, though, you see this idea of friend being used in a very generous way with the apostles and I think by extension all people. What does that tell you or suggest about the New Testament or New Covenant? It's a lesson that we've seen in other places, other times, other circumstances. Old Testament, you're able to freely approach God? No. Who do you have go to God on your behalf?
Priest.
You go get a priest, and he's going to be the intermediary. But now with the New Testament, it's been, remember the veil torn apart in association with Jesus' death? That veil has been torn apart. The Old Testament has been brought down. Now the Bible talks about, for example, in Hebrews chapter 4, we can approach the throne of God freely. Jesus, I think, kind of hints at the same thing when he says you can now be a friend of God. So it is one way of illustrating the great blessings that we have in the New Testament. All right, we finished up with John chapter 15, verse 15 last week. Let's read that and then read our new passage, John 15, 16. He said, no longer do I call you servants, for the servant knoweth not what his Lord doeth. But have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known unto you. Then this is new. He says, ye did not choose me, but I chose you, and appointed you, that ye should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide. And whatsoever ye shall ask the Father in my name, he will, or he shall, give that to you. He's going to deliver that to you. Here in verse 16, the connection between this passage and John 15, verse 15, is not all that clear. There is a connection, but exactly how Jesus was trying to tie the thought from verse 15 into verse 16 is a little murky in my mind. Now, you do have, as you look at the context back there, especially in John 15, verses 1 through 5. He said the apostles were going to be producing fruit. There were going to be a variety of good things that they were going to produce in conjunction with the kingdom of heaven. And now Jesus is still dealing with that kind of thing and making the point that a holy God can have friends or can be friends with unholy men. And others have suggested that the Lord was trying to express his love for the apostles in this verse. That would tie into verse 15. He said, you didn't choose me. Typically, if you're going to initiate, well, that's a bad question. If you're going to initiate a friendship with someone, it can happen in a lot of different ways, can it? You know, you might be both stuck on a desert island. That was not something that you intended, but there was a plane crash, everybody died, but you and this guy 10 rows back, and you become friends. Now, that's probably not the way that it happens for most people, but generally, if you want to be a friend with someone, what's the typical process? Somebody has to do some reaching, right? If I want to be friends with you, I either have to reach out, or you as an individual, you must reach towards me. There has to be something that prompts that. Well, if the Lord had allowed these men to reach out and be friends with him, would that have been okay? All right, sure. Nothing inherently wrong with that. But how important was the mission that Jesus had been given to perform? Really important. And because that mission was so essential, rather than letting just people come to him, what did the Lord do? He went to them. We do that in the world, don't we? Are there not times where maybe a company is searching for a CEO? And you might have people apply. But the people who are trying to steer that company, they will generally go out and say, we need the guy over here. That's why they hire a headhunter sometimes. You know, this is the guy, this is the woman, this is the team that we need. And Jesus makes it very, very clear that these men did not choose him. He specifically chose them. Now, some in thinking about that have said, well, here is an example. Here is a proof text in the Bible for the idea that man does not have free will. God chose these men and they did not have the ability to decline the choice. If somebody made that statement to you, what would you say? Okay, I've got two thoughts here, Betty. I think you got the jumping in by just a bit, so I'll let you start. All right, I think if you're going to try to illustrate that, that would be where I would go as well. Judas was chosen. He was numbered with the apostles, Acts chapter 1. He fell away. So he would certainly demonstrate that fact. Doug?
To go along with it, there's other verse that talks about we were chosen and predestined.
Yes.
So you'll have to deal with the predestined too, because so many people say, well, there's nothing I can do because he says that we were predestined to be conformed into the image of the Son. And so they use this and they use this verse. But
yes, they will.
Again, they got to decide who he's really talking to here too.
Yes.
In that case, he chose them, he chooses us to be conformed to the image of the Son, but we have to do something, just aren't conformed.
That's right. People today, for example, let's take your point and put it into terms which we've never used to illustrate the thought in any of our teaching or preaching here, at least anything that's been done by me. Would you say that a business owner predestines employees to be hired, fired, and not hired? One more time. Would you say a business owner who's involved with managing his or her people or their people is involved with, as we look at it in biblical terms, predestining the hiring, the firing,
he'd never be successful
and not selecting people? He has to do that.
He has to, otherwise
now,
he'd never be successful.
Right. By that, we don't mean that he's come up with a list of everybody in the world. What do we mean? All right, he's designed classes. If you're in this class, you're fired. If you're in this class and we need some people, you're hired. If you're in this class, you're looking for a job, we're looking for help, we're not going to hire you. So this is exactly parallel to what we find in the world, and nobody misunderstands it when we look at this from a secular standpoint. But when it comes to the Bible, people see that word predestined, I chose you, and they just draw all kinds of weird conclusions because they're predisposed towards some false ideas because of what they've been taught. Okay. Done?
How do you define predestined for?
Choose in advance. For example, would an employee...
That's the point. How far in advance?
Well, when you look at God, you would, I think, have to look at that from the standpoint of eternity. If Jesus was the Lamb that was foreknown by God, slain from the foundation of the world, and you can make that point in conjunction with an employer too, do you not? Now, once again, that's not going to be true for every employer. But generally, before an employer puts out an ad in the paper, before an employer puts out an ad on the web, what do they have in their head?
What they're looking for.
All right. They know what they need to have a qualified person come and do that job. So they have predestined those qualifications or those job requirements so people then act in a way consistent with their free will. They can come, they can try to lie their way into the job. You think people try to do that when it comes to the church? Pretend to be a sheep when they're a goat? Sure. So many different applications there.
They do that in jobs too.
Yes. Absolutely. Doug, go ahead.
On that, it says like the word predestined is what they get hung up with, but if they read on further, they can say they were predestined to be conformed to this. So
yeah.
There's many times that he talks about Christians following a certain way before they're accepted as being a Christian. That one is the only one that right now I can think about, but he talks about what we have to do, and this is where you get in the arguments or the discussions. Some make it arguments, but James talking about faith without works is dead.
Yeah, you go back.
It's either faith without works is dead or faith with works is dead. Which one is it? You know, you have to choose.
And you go back to that class, that group of people. That class was predestined to salvation. They were appointed to salvation. Why? Because the people who become members of that class are going to choose to live in a way that's in accordance with God's will, and because of that choice, they will end up in heaven at the right time. The people who chose not to follow that way, God had a class predestined for them. The unsaved would be that class, and for those who made that choice, or choice which leads to that lifestyle, they will be in that class and thus suffer that consequence.
Now, here's a question with the John or Nick. Jesus said, I chose you. Could he, then those disciples says, no. You know, they had the free will to say no.
Yeah.
But he knew they weren't going to say no.
Yeah. Well, there, again, would be going back to the employer-employee relationship. An employer might say, these are the qualities or the qualifications that I want in the job. And then you get to a point where you bring somebody in that has every one of those qualities. Might they still be the wrong person for the job? Do you think some employers have thought that they needed a person who possessed these skills and it turned out they were very wrong in their assessment? Sure. That's not going to happen with God. God knew what he really needed, and he knew, because he declares the end from the beginning, Isaiah chapter 46, verse 10, not that we're robots and we're controlled. I mean, we chose to come here tonight. We chose not to come if we're not in this assembly. We had the free will to make those decisions. And he simply knows the choice that people are going to make, and we have free will with that. A lot of people struggle to put those two things together. I don't have a perfect explanation for how they go together, but that would be one of the, as I think it's Deuteronomy 29, 29, it says the secret things belong to God. And that would be one of the passages where we would find that associated with that kind of idea. Anybody else? Okay, let's take a look at a couple of the things. In this day and time, and we have to some degree, a certain degree, the same kind of thing today. Do kids ever get to choose their teachers?
Not usually.
Actually, they do.
Occasionally. I mean, it's not often. But maybe in your high school years or maybe in your grade school years, you have this math teacher, you have this math teacher for maybe some science subjects as well. Do you want to go this way? Do you want to go this way? Do you want to take the teacher that can teach French, or do you want to take the language specialist who can teach Spanish? Those kinds of things. Well, this was the same way it worked in the first century. If you were going to find someone, a rabbi, to follow, you generally chose the rabbi. I've listened to this guy, or I've heard good things about this guy, or dad has been taught by this rabbi, and I want to follow in dad's steps. I want to do what my friends have done. But Jesus says specifically, and as I said before, the Greek text is emphatic. Jesus said, you did not choose me. No way. Didn't happen. I was the one who came out and chose you. And there were some reasons for that. Even, I think, for choosing Judas. Now, if you have the King James translation, you might be in your head wondering if I was going to deal with the King James rendering of this. Anybody have the King James translation? You probably don't have appointed. What's it say? 16, John 15.
You did not choose me, I chose you, appointed to you to bear fruit that would last.
Okay. Is that the King James?
Yeah. I have King James.
You don't see the word ordained there?
Yeah, I do. I have it. Ye have not chosen me, but I have chosen you and ordained you, that ye should go and bring forth fruit, and that your fruit should remain, that whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you.
Okay, thank you. That was a word that I was looking for. You may have in your translation the word ordained. Now, in ordained time, when we hear that word or when people use that word, what do they generally mean by ordained? I'm ordained. Well, okay, it could be with Catholicism, it could be with the Lutherans, you find it there. What do they mean by that, though? I'm ordained. Well, that's really a quick and good summation of it. I'm special. There has been this religious governing body for Group X, and they have chosen to confer upon me ordination. And now I'm an ordained minister. Sometimes that's a man. Often in the past it's been exclusively men, and now sometimes it refers to women. Well, when you see that word, and you may want to put a marginal note here, it doesn't mean anything like the world means. It simply means appointed to a function. If you were in the job, and the person who is your boss says, we're ordaining you to be the trash collector. Well, I don't think anybody would look at that and think, boy, I've really got a glorified job. I've been ordained to trash collecting. But that word would mean just what we find here in John chapter 15, verse 16. You've been appointed to this role. You've been tasked with carrying out this function. This is now going to be one of your duties, that kind of thing. And that's what Jesus was saying. There was no special collar that they got. There was no special ceremony. There was no special certificate. In fact, if people went and looked at the word that's translated appointed or ordained here, they'd find that the same word is used in Acts chapter 20, verse 28. And in that passage, in that reference, Paul talks about elders. Elders were made shepherds over the flock. They were ordained over the flock, if we were to follow the King James translation. And nobody thinks there, I believe, I've never come across anybody that believes elders were appointed by some kind of special clerical body and they went around wearing white robes. So that's helpful, I think, in showing people what the word does not mean. Now, as Jesus talks about these men, he says that a big part of their life, a big part of their efforts was going to involve bearing fruit. The word bearing there in John 15, verse 16, is expressed with the present tense. And I'm inclined here to, we've talked about the fact before that bearing fruit is not exclusively evangelistic work. Here, though, it seems to me that that's probably going to be what he was likely thinking about. Our study in John happens to line up very well with what we're looking at next, because Jesus is just hours from the cross here in John chapter 15, and in the book of Acts you have, just after the resurrection, information being given about that time. And Jesus is preparing these men for what happened about 40 days later. That was Acts 1, verse 8. He said, you're going to be my witnesses where? Down there in Jerusalem, and then Judea, and then Samaria, and then all over the ends of the earth. And to me, this seems to be a direct relation to that, Acts chapter 1, verse 8, that he's telling them, you're going to bear, present tense, fruit. And then he says something else, which I find to be kind of fascinating. It's an easy point to overlook. Take a look, this is just about in the middle of verse 16, that your fruit should remain. Or the ESV says that your fruit should abide. This is also expressed with the present tense. Now let's think about that for a second. Jesus says, here, I want your fruit. I want your efforts. I want your work to continue, to abide, to remain, to be ongoing. What do you think he meant by that, or intended by that? How could we relate that to our day and time? Let your fruit last. All right.
It had to be written down, so that was part of the fruits
of their life. Absolutely. That was a very important part, that word would remain heaven, and was certainly going to have a hand in helping that be fulfilled, but we would put that as part of our answer. What else? I want your work to abide.
Those people that you see that are converted will stay with them. You'll see that those that you start converting will stay around.
Okay.
There's going to be some that are going to leave, but
right.
They're going to stay. There's going to be, what they're doing is not going to be in vain.
All right. Successive generations of Christians. That was God's will, for people to continue to abide in the faith and follow what was right. What else? I want your work to abide. Let's try to put it in our terms today. Do we want some of our work to abide?
Yeah, to be sustained. It's not just do it once and it's gone after a short time.
It is. Exactly. A lot of our work in the secular realm. For example, anybody do dishes tonight? All right. Is that work going to abide? Probably not for long. I mean, if you got some glasses out of the cabinet, you got some plates, or you used the microwave and cleaned it, those things are going to get dirty again. I mean, maybe you go home and get a late night snack, and your work abided for, maybe less than 2 hours. But even though, and you put that into some of the things that people do around the building, walked out tonight and got the mail, somebody had mowed the grass, they did a nice job. From the standpoint of just cutting that grass, how long is that work going to abide? Okay, it could be a couple days depending on the rain that's in the forecast, or maybe it'll be a week or maybe a week and a half. So that work may not abide in that sense for very long, but do you think it abides in another sense? The dishes that were put away, the grass that was cut, do you think that work abides in another way? Okay. And along with that pattern, you also have an example, don't you? What about teaching kids a basic principle? Dishes get dirty, what happens? Dishes get clean. Dishes get dirty, dishes get clean. You think kids need to know that? Now that's a secular example of what Doug was talking about, but succeeding generations. What about trying to do some maintenance work around the building? Teaching people. So some of our work influence, that may abide for a long, long time. From a spiritual standpoint, conversions that I may also help work to abide for a long, long time. But as Christians, we should try to be busy in as many works as we can, because oftentimes those can abide, those can do great, great things. I'll come back to that and see if you have a thought before we leave this verse. At the latter part of verse 16, we have something that we've already seen before, back in John 14, 13, and also earlier in this chapter, John 15, verse 7. But let's see if we can see a difference. Here, at the end of verse 17, he says, I've called your friends, and then all things that I heard from... Let's see, 16, I've got ahead of myself, or behind myself. Whatsoever ye shall ask of the Father in my name, he may give it to you. Well, let's back up a little bit, John 14, verse 13. Compare 14, 13 with what we have here in 15, 16, and see if there's any difference. 14, 13 says, and whatsoever ye shall ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. Any difference between that and what we find over here in John chapter 15, verse 16? Who's the one doing and giving in John 14?
Christ.
Jesus is. Who's the one doing and giving in John chapter 15?
God.
Huh. Isn't that interesting? Somebody looks at that and says, well, that's interesting. Here the Bible says Christ will do it. Over there the Bible says the Father will do it. You've got a Bible contradiction. What would you say? Same authority might be part of the answer. What else?
God and Father are one.
All right. That would be the other part, and I think maybe even the bigger part of the answer. That, yes, deity is so united, the will is so harmonious, that when you speak of someone doing something, you might refer to it as the Father, you might refer to it as the Son. But they are in complete sync, if you will. Then you also have, in John chapter 15, verse 7, to kind of tie all this together, something that's unique as well. He says, if ye abide in me and my words abide in you, ask whatsoever ye will, and what?
It shall be done unto you.
Okay. Now that's a nice complimentary reference, isn't it? One passage says the Father will do it. One passage says the Son will do it. And now the third passage simply says what? It's going to be done. You don't need to worry who's going to be the one who specifically carries out that will. One of the other practical points or applications from this verse is found in the idea of barrenness. God has never intended for his people to be barren. He did not intend for the people of Israel to be barren, that is, lacking in producing fruit for him. And today, the same thing is still true for Christians. There can be times where Christians think, well, all that church work, who's that done by? Done by the preacher. Or it's done by the elders. Or it's done by the deacons, or it's done by the Bible class teachers, it's done by the person we hire. No, it is a unified effort. Now, some people may have more time, they may have more opportunity, they may have more knowledge, they may have more experience, they may have more this, 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 and this. But all of God's people should try to be productive. They should be trying to produce fruit. Okay, going back and asking what we asked about earlier, as far as if you want to talk about anything as far as abiding fruit. Any additional thoughts on that? Brian?
1 Corinthians 3, where talk about some people building on the foundation with wood, hay, and stubble, and others says that any man's work abides, he'll receive a reward.
Yeah. I think the word there refers to converts, which kind of goes back to what Doug was talking about, but that's God's will, that abide, and that person head the same way in the spiritual realm. Tying into that for just a second, if there's a person who has become a Christian, a younger Christian, in a local congregation, do you think there's anything that we can do to help that Christian abide? Remain faithful? I'm sure. Would you say that that's God's will, that we seek to offer the encouragement or help that we can, that's within our ability to aid that person? Abide? Yeah. What about the aged Christian? Somebody who maybe can't get out too often, maybe in a nursing home, the health has failed, somebody who has perhaps gone to the hospital, and the doc has said you're probably going to live a couple more weeks up here in the hospital, and then you're going to be dead. You think that might take a toll on a person's faith? I suspect so. But there are some, I mean, that's going to challenge you at that time. You've been told that, you know, on day X, 14 days from now, you're likely going to be dead if you make it that long. And if you make it that long, you probably don't have much longer. But ideally, Christians will help that person abide, and will also receive the same thing if and when we come to that time and experience in life. Final thought before we look at 17. Okay. John 15, verse 17. Jesus said, these things I command you, that ye may love one another. Now, This word command is the same word that Jesus used over there in Matthew chapter 28 when he talked about, I command you to go into the world. And here it's used, same word, but it's used in a slightly different way. He said, I command you these things, one of those items being love. As we've talked about before, this statement was given just hours before Jesus went to the cross, so this was one of the final things that he said. Now, I don't know if Jesus said these words to repeat what he's already said. He's talked about love, and we'll look at the references here. So it may be just kind of a recap, a summary reminder, or his command to love one another, that may have been the basis for some other things that he was going to say in the future. So whether it was tied to the past stuff or tied to things that he was about to say, I don't know, maybe it was tied to both. But those are at least two or three possibilities. If you back up a little bit, John chapter 13. John chapter 13, verses 34 and 35, you have essentially the same information back there. That was when he was washing the feet and so forth. He said, a new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, even as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. By this shall all men know that ye are my disciples, if ye have love one for another. Then over in John chapter 15, verses 12 through 13, verses that we recently covered, he said, this is my commandment, that ye love one another, even as I have loved you. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life. That was last week's class. Now, what he says here, and there's a point of application in it, what he says here must have made a huge, huge impression on at least some of the disciples. And one of those disciples would have been the Apostle John. Now bear in mind what we've seen from John chapter 13, what we are now seeing from John chapter 15, verse 17, and also that other verse, John chapter 15, verses 12 and 13. And let's skip over to the book of 3 John. Man, the apostle who wrote the book of John, also wrote 3 John. And, you know, we may be dealing with the time, you know, 40 or so years later. But notice, still thinking about what we have in John chapter 13 and John chapter 15, notice what John says beginning in 1 John chapter 3, verse 11. For this is the message which he heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. 1 John verse 3, or chapter 3, moving down to verse 14. He said, we know that we've passed out of death into life, because we love the brethren. And then 1 John 3, 16 to 18. He says, hereby we know love, because he laid down his life for us. And remember, that's the context of John chapter 15. Jesus has been talking about love, and he's about just hours later to lay down his life. And we ought to lay down our lives for the brethren. But whoso hath the world's goods, and beholdeth his brother in need, and shutteth up his compassion from him, how doth the love of God abide in him? My little children, let us not love in word, neither with our tongue, but in deed and truth. And then just a little bit later, same chapter, 1 John 3, verse 23. And this is his commandment that we, notice that word commandment again, this is his commandment that we should believe in the name of his Son Jesus Christ and love one another even as he gave us commandment. That word is used a second time. Then next chapter, 1 John chapter 4, verse 7. Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is begotten of God and knoweth God. Then 1 John 4, verses 11 and 12. He says in verse 11, beloved, if God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. No man hath beheld God at any time. If we love one another, God abideth in us, and his love is perfected in us. And then in verses 20 and 21, final two verses in the chapter. If a man say, I love God, and hates his brother, he's a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, cannot love God whom he hath not seen. And this commandment, there's that word again, have we from him, that he who loveth God loveth his brother also. Then finally in 1 John 5, verse 2, hereby we know that we love the children of God when we love God and do his commandments. Now here's a point of application. Jesus talks about love just before he dies. John, maybe 40 or so years later, brings up this same point. And I mean, he just goes after it and after it and after it and after it. Do you think that John was influenced by what Jesus had to say when it came to love? I think we have to say that because the wording is so similar. Now, let's take that and make it relevant to our day and time. Do you think we influence people? Absolutely. The power of influence is demonstrated in my mind by John chapter 15 and the references to love in 1 John chapter 4. It's possible we know for influence to work in reverse. Bad influences. 1 Corinthians 15, 33, evil companionships corrupt. There's the influence. Evil companionships corrupt good morals. But John also teaches this, that even after 40 years, influence can be a positive thing. Well, that kind of takes us back to what we talked about from John chapter 15, verse 16, doesn't it? Jesus said, I want you to produce fruit, present tense. And that fruit, I want it to abide. I want that fruit to remain, present tense. Well, that's what happened, from what I can tell, with Jesus, his discussion about love, the Apostle John, about four decades later, and surely with the other apostles. You can also relate this to some other ideas in the Bible. Train up a child in the way he shall go, and he's not going to depart from it. Now, that's not an ironclad guarantee, but what is it? You've influenced a child. Just as you would take a tender tree and bend it in a certain way and let it grow, there is a reasonably good chance that that child is going to pattern his life in the right way. And even if that goes awry for a time, you still have put what in that child's heart? You've planted a seed. And that seed, it might be stepped on, it might be exposed to fire, might be exposed to all kinds of difficult things, but still you have put something there that is almost impossible to destroy. A child may bury it, a child may try to forget it, but one day, and history bears this out, one day that seed may germinate. You might be dead by the time that that seed takes place. But that should comfort every Christian who has someone that they love, whether that is a family member or not, that has not followed the right path, that seed one day can and just may take root and grow and be very, very productive. So it's, in my mind, a great illustration of a really important point. Thoughts that you want to add or ask before we look at verse 18? Okay. John 15, now looking at the 18th verse. Here he goes on to say, if the world hateth you, ye know that it hath hated me before it hated you. Now, what did we just read about in John chapter 15, verse, let's see. I grabbed some information from my notes and got off there for just a second. So let's back up. Let's just pretend that that's off the record. We've got the love that Christ has talked about for his people. We just went through that with the book of 1 John, and we just saw that from verse 17. So I wanted 17, and it just wasn't quite there in my mind yet. All right, so we've got this love for one another. But in contrast to that love that Christians have one for another, what do we have in conjunction with God's people in the world?
Hate.
And not just hate, but sometimes a lot of hate. When Jesus said, the world is going to respond to you with hate, here's another passage where the tense makes a lot of difference. What do you think he used as far as the tense when he said, the world's going to hate you?
Continuous
action, ongoing action, present tense. He says, the world is not going to like you day after day, month after month, year after year, decade after decade, century after century. Hasn't that proven true? You can just look at world history and see how people, not all of whom were quite doing things correctly, but the world hated what they stood for. And then Jesus tells his apostles this. He says, you know the world, present tense, hates you. Let's go back to that verb know for a little bit. Once again, the tense. You know, what tense?
Ongoing.
All right, it's once again the ongoing tense. Jesus says you've had this knowledge for a long time. How would they have gotten that knowledge?
Firsthand.
All right. I mean, they've seen how Jesus has been treated, especially in the book of John. You got the Jews, who often refer to a hostile force. They've come against him. People have wanted to kill him. And when he talked about going to Jerusalem, one of the apostles said, well, let's go so we can die with him. So, I mean, they had a pretty good idea that Jesus was not loved by many, many people. The hate directed against the Lord, the hate directed against him, as far as the verb tense, it's also significant. He says, they have hated me. There it's not present tense, it's perfect tense. Now that to me increases the significance even more. It's not just that they've been hating me, but they've hated me from way back when. And isn't that really true? When you go back and you think about the struggle between light and darkness, good and evil, sin and righteousness, how long has it been ongoing? Really, since the beginning. I mean, Adam and Eve were in that perfect state for a while. Satan comes in, and almost immediately, Genesis chapter 3, you begin to see the ongoing struggle against truth and error between what's right and what is wrong. As Jesus says, the world has hated me. Once again, I know we've said this several times, but think about this statement in the context of where it occurs. What's going to happen just a few hours after he makes this very statement in John 15, verse 18? He's going to be put on the cross. Now, doesn't that put a new spin on hating Christ? He says, the world has hated me. Now, do you want to see in just a few hours the ultimate illustration of that? Look at the cross. Look at what precedes the cross. You're going to see me hurt. You're going to see me physically abused. You're going to see me verbally mistreated. And this is going to be the culmination of the hatred of the world towards me. And if they've hated me, buddy, they're also going to hate you and do that on a present, on a regular basis. Some examples, some class examples of how the world hates Bible-believing people. What would you put forth as far as some illustrations?
Ridicule.
All right. Yeah, when we think about persecution, it comes in various degrees. Not everybody is going to be killed. Not everybody is going to be physically assaulted, but there certainly will be some verbal assaults. So when we think about that, we would put that in there. What else would we say? You can offer some general answers, or you can look at some specific cases, some specific examples in our day and time.
When you're dealing with your jobs, you want Sundays off or whatever, you have to fight for it.
All right.
Where even in this country in the past, you didn't have to.
Yeah. Now, depending on the employer might be religiously inclined, but you're right. There are many cases where a person says, the medical environment might be one good example of that. It's Sunday. People are still going to be sick, so if you want to keep the job, work it or walk. So you're right when it comes to employers and employees. What else? Well, what about what we find with the Kim Davis matter down in Kentucky? The clerk, same-sex marriage licenses, fire her. Get rid of her. We hate her. It's interesting to me, somebody asked what I thought about that, and after giving it a lot of consideration, I side, this is a personal judgment, but I side on the idea of religious tolerance. The government tolerates a lot of things religiously. For example, if you're a conscientious objector, the government says we can make accommodations for that. When you look at the Amish and the Mennonite in our area, once again, you find that their religious faith is accommodated. So there are many examples, I think, as you look at American history, American society currently, where there has been a religious accommodation. Now, that can only go so far. But with Muslims, you see the same kind of thing. Sometimes it's not necessarily in a government office, but it may be if you're going to come into this place, you can't have on any religious head covering, or we've got to, you know, check you out to make sure that there are no weapons on you, those kinds of things. So for the sake of consistency, I think you can make a really good case that there should have been some kind of accommodation made for her, and maybe there still will be, and maybe what the current arrangement is will still fall into that line of thought. But there is that, certainly within reason. What else? The world hates you.
Praying in schools.
All right. When we think of our schools, can't pray in school, at least in most places, can't pray at a school event like a football game, basketball game. I didn't really look at the whole story, but just caught a little bit of the headline. There is a coach, Steve, maybe you can help me out here. I think it's for a high school team. But at some point in a football game, he goes out to the 50-yard line and has a prayer. Does that ring a bell with anybody? Okay. Oh, okay, well, these two of us have seen the story. But anyway, he's in hot water now. You know, that's, you know, can't have that. So there are a lot of ways where we find in our day and time religious hostility. Somebody shared a link today, and I was appreciative of that, but it talked about a religious group in Texas. The highlights were there was an unarmed man. He entered into a church building and said Allah ordered him to slay the infidels. So at least a few heads are nodding. A few people were able to see that. And when we think about hate, some of it comes from unstable people. Now, you probably can't do a lot with an unstable person when it comes to hate. I mean, you can de-escalate the situation, and you can try to maybe tone things down or restrain the person, those kinds of items. But, I mean, unstable people are unstable people, so you just really can't do a whole lot with them. But the real problem would be with accountable people. That is, they are stable. They are able to rationalize correct thought. But they just simply hate the idea of God. They hate the idea of a Bible. They hate the idea of people being religious. And it just really knocks them off the rocker. And if they're not willing to stop with verbal assaults, sometimes that can lead to death. Doug?
One item I think about is when they're talking about the Big Bang Theory. I mean, to me, the most moronic thing you can do, but they're supposed to be the highly intelligent ones.
Yeah.
But how much they slam creation, especially Hawkins, I think he's the one that's in the wheelchair, and how he he slams and how ridiculous creation is. But as you go down it and see how many of these scientists later were converted, fighting the truth so long, they finally realized that, oh, maybe I looked at this wrong. Huh. You're seeing more and more of that, but still, that's another science in schools. Anything they teach slams anything that deals with God or a deity.
Yeah. In the academic realm, there have been some credentialed professors, PhDs, who have had their degrees for a long time, and after they start talking about religion or here's something that can't be explained by naturalistic means, those kinds of things, there are movements to fire the guy, revoke his degree, and kick him off the staff, or if they can't do that, at least put him in a department where his influence is mitigated. It's really limited, those kinds of things. And when you look at the other people who have gone into atheism, some of the secularists, when they talk about religion, I mean, it is just venomous. It's not, we don't want anything to do with you, we believe you're wrong, but it is just absolute verbal hostility to the greatest degree. So when we see what Jesus talks about here just before he dies in John 15, verse 18, it should be encouraging to us to know that we're just not in this for the first time since Christianity came into being. This is an old, old problem, and the Lord tells us, people, if you've signed up to be on my side, this is going to be one of the consequences, and you still need to be willing to speak out. You can't be a friend of the world, can't be a friend of God. James 4:4, John also talked about this in the book of 1 John chapter 13. Now, let's take it and look at it from a first century perspective for just a little bit. If you were a Christian, did you get some hostility from the Jews? Oh, yeah. I mean, you just start early in the book of Acts with about Acts chapter 3, and you can just work your way through the book. And it is incident after incident with the Jewish authorities. For example, with Paul, there were times where the Jews actually chased the guy over to another city. Now, can you imagine being so upset with people that you might chase some people from here down to maybe Indianapolis or from here over to Toledo, Ohio, just to persecute them? That, to me, is almost incomprehensible. But that's what we find in the book of Acts about some of the Jews. The Romans. And about the only reference I think that you can make to this in the New Testament would be 1 Peter chapter 4, verse 16, where he talks about the fiery persecution, and his readers surely were under Roman rule. You have what we talked about a bit from the book of Revelation, and that would be emperor worship. Emperor worship was designed to unify the citizens of Rome. When you look at Rome, and you go back and you probably have a Bible map for this, I mean, its borders were extensive. It included countries like North Africa, and went all the way over to the Euphrates River. So, I mean, it was a giant, giant area. Had a lot of different people, had a lot of different countries. In fact, in some ways, it's a little bit like America. You know, you go to certain parts of our country, and they don't speak English, they speak that language, and you've got this segment, for example, they talk about Chinatown or Little Mexico, or you have over here people, who may be involved with French, the French way of life, those kinds of things. Well, that's sort of what the Roman Empire was like. And they needed some way to tie everybody together. Well, when we're going through the book of Revelation, we made the point that two of the most powerful forces on the earth are what? Remember?
Government
and religion. So if you want to unify people, you obviously have the government. But if you can reach out and use that second great power of religion, well, now you've really gotten a handle on things. If you go back and you look at emperor worship, I think you'll find, and this is surprising to some people, but I think you'll find that emperor worship was not a creation of the government. Emperor worship was not a creation of the government. The people saw a need, and they said, well, let's create this religion where the emperors are worshipped, and I think there's enough information out there to show that initially the emperors didn't want it. But you know, it's like anything else. If you're in that position of power and people are willing to call you a god for a little while, oh, no, 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 we don't need that. How long do you think that protest is going to last? Exactly right. That's an old, old story. And it didn't take very long. So they thought that was a great idea. And you can do it all in the name of having a unified people. Well, to keep that intact, what they did was they had the citizens go out and pinch a little incense at least once a year to Caesar and say that Caesar was Lord. What, do you think that was a problem for the Jews? Ten Commandments. Thou shalt have no other God before me. Well, if you were a Jew pinching incense to Caesar, that was idolatry. Can't do that. You think that was also a problem for the Christians? There's only one Lord. Ephesians 4, verses 4 and 5. So you certainly couldn't say that Caesar was Lord. If you didn't do that, you didn't get a certificate. And if you didn't get that certificate, it would be today. Like, you've got a passport to go from one country to another. You've got a driver's license that allows you, if you're checked, to continue on and those kinds of things. If you didn't have that certificate, oftentimes you couldn't buy, you couldn't trade, you couldn't sell. If you had a business without the certificate, you couldn't work. Your work wouldn't be accepted. You couldn't go down to the grocery store and buy food. Or suppose, if you look at it in terms of today, if you don't have your certificate, you don't get your Social Security check. You think that would put the hurt on some folks? It would.